Today is Monday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Gene Adolfo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, G20 leaders approve a sweeping 15% global tax rate and carbon neutrality by mid-century.
The leaders in Rome essentially agreed to reach the goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Thousands of demonstrators demand the restoration of a civilian-led government in Sudan.
One witness said they heard gunshots and saw people being carried away bleeding in the city of Omdurman.
And the WHO begins a campaign to cut millions of road traffic deaths and injuries by at least half by 2030. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The G20 summit hosted by Italy in Rome this weekend brought together leaders from the world's major economies where they discussed issues of mutual concern, including the pandemic recovery and climate change. They agreed on a sweeping 15% global tax rate and carbon neutrality by mid-century. For more, I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara, who is traveling with U.S. President Joe Biden.
The leaders in Rome essentially agreed to reach the goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. This is in line with the global commitment made in Paris in 2015 to keep global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius. However, the leaders failed to achieve an agreement in terms of phasing out coal because G20 members, China and India, have resisted attempts to produce a declaration on phasing out domestic coal consumption.
How influential was the U.S. President Joe Biden in nudging these leaders to agree to a net zero neutrality, since he's been the one pushing this?
He has been pushing it, but so has other countries. I mean, obviously, this is an issue of contention between the developing countries and developed countries, and that is the issue of climate financing. Now, U.S. President Joe Biden has been pushing this idea that wealthy countries should provide at least $100 billion a year to support developing countries' transition from fossil fuels to renewables to mitigate climate change. But despite all the pledges, there are still a lot of funding that hasn't been materialized. So this is one of the issues of contention at this summit. And so despite these declarations and despite these pledges, it does remain to be seen, despite with U.S. support, it does remain to be seen whether or not those pledges will be fulfilled.
Without the presence of Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese leader Xi, the spotlight seems to be on the American President Joe Biden. How is that going?
So the White House has described the fact that Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin are absent as an opportunity for the U.S. and the Europeans to lead the agenda on a number of issues. However, we know that President Joe Biden puts a lot of value in face-to-face diplomacy, and there may be missed opportunities there in trying to get these leaders together to solve a range of issues. So one example that I can raise is the global supply chain meeting that was convened by President Joe Biden on Sunday afternoon. Only 15 countries out of the 20 showed up, and notably absent was China. And in fact, President Xi Jinping, in his remarks to G20 leaders, called for or proposed to create an international forum to solve the global supply chain crisis. So this is an issue where the U.S. and China has an opportunity to work together, and rather they are sort of operating on separate tracks, trying to compete to lead on this issue. And you know, many analysts say that there are actually missed opportunities here for the U.S. to work together with China as well as Russia. And really nothing can replace in-person diplomacy, particularly at summits like this, when sometimes the most important deals happen on the sideline.
As part of the discussions and the meetings, President Biden met with Turkish President Erdogan. With all these simmering issues, how did that go?
So you can see from the body language of both of these leaders that it was very stiff. It was not a very warm meeting. And as you said, there are many simmering tensions. There are strategic disagreements between the two. There is, of course, issue of defense hardware. In 2019, if you would recall, the Trump administration kicked Turkey out of the F-35 program because Ankara purchased a number of Russian S-400 air defense system. And now Turkey wants to buy F-16 fighter jets. But Congress is saying, you know, let's not sell them to Turkey because essentially Ankara is behaving like an adversary. So this was an important meeting, certainly for President Biden to send some messages to Turkey about what is and what's not acceptable behavior from a NATO ally. And out of the meeting, the White House official who briefed reporters is essentially saying that nothing has been agreed so far, but the two countries will continue to talk to each other and try to maintain relationships because neither Washington nor Ankara, because both Washington and Ankara have an interest to keep relationships stable. President Joe Biden certainly can't afford another regional crisis post-Afghanistan withdrawal. And meanwhile, President Erdogan is embattled politically and having economic issues at home.
That's VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara speaking with me from Rome. Leaders of the G20 have gathered in Rome to firm up commitments on climate change ahead of the UN's COP26 summit. But their draft communique shows some pledges are vague or watered down. Lucy Fielder of Reuters reports.
Leaders of the group of 20 major economies will say they aim to cap global warming at the 1.5 degrees Celsius level, but will largely avoid firm commitments, according to a draft joint statement seen by Reuters. 1.5 degrees is the level scientists say is vital to avoid disaster, but some of the world's biggest polluters have still not committed to it. G20 leaders gathered on Saturday for a two-day summit in Rome, but the fifth draft of their joint statement shows tough negotiations on wording has in places only weakened it. Keeping 1.5 degrees within reach will require meaningful and effective actions by all countries, it says, where a previous draft called for immediate action. And the planned communique offers little detail on how countries will curb emissions. It says leaders recognize the, quote, key relevance of achieving net zero carbon emissions by the middle of the century. But China, the largest global emitter of greenhouse gases, has set a 2060 target date. The role of the G20, whose nations are responsible for an estimated 80% of global greenhouse gas emissions, is crucial ahead of the UN's COP26 climate summit, to be held in Glasgow, Scotland next week. It includes a pledge to halt financing of overseas coal-fired power generation by the end of this year and to, quote, do our utmost to stop building new coal power plants before the end of the 2030s. Fossil fuel subsidies are to be phased out over the medium term. Leaders look likely to fall short of demands by developing countries on so-called climate financing, where richer countries help poorer ones to finance their green transitions. UN experts say that even if current national plans are fully implemented, the world is heading for global warming of 2.7 degrees, with a catastrophic acceleration of events such as drought, storms and flooding.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. Parts of the planet that were once thought to be permanently frozen are starting to thaw, posing problems for countries like Russia, where permafrost covers vast areas of its territory. The thaw is threatening Russia's oil economy, as Alexander Yanevsky tells us in this report narrated by Amy Katz.
Last year, a thermal power plant in Krasnoyarsk, Russia, failed, flooding nearby rivers with some 17,500 tons of diesel oil. It was the first large-scale disaster of its kind in the Arctic, says Greenpeace. The Kremlin blamed local authorities for the spill, but many scientists and the company that owns the plant say the region's thawing permafrost is to blame because it weakens support for the fuel tank. Vladimir Romanovsky teaches geophysics at the University of Alaska.
This thawing process, melting ice, will lead to changes in topography and microtopography. So where is a lot of ice, this surface will be subsiding rapidly. It's not good for ecosystem generally. It's not good for infrastructure. These changes are impacting not only directly people who live there and work there, but also it has some impact on infrastructure in general, in things like energy security, food and water security, and national security.
The melting permafrost will produce even more carbon emissions, causing climate change, says Romanovsky.
Of course, very well known, this permafrost carbon feedback. So because permafrost contain a significant amount of carbon in frozen form, and by estimates of scientists, it's about twice more carbon in permafrost regions sequestered in soils compared to amount of carbon in the atmosphere. So roughly speaking, if all of this carbon will release to the atmosphere, the amount of carbon in the atmosphere will be tripled.
And it's not only Russia that faces these problems. The U.S. has felt the consequences of permafrost melting too. Scientists say the governments of countries with areas of permafrost on their territories need to prepare for an increase in spending to maintain the existing infrastructure to keep it functional. For Oleksandr Yanevsky in Washington, Amy Katz, VOA News.
Over the objections of the Biden administration, the Supreme Court has agreed to consider a climate change case that could limit the authority of the Environmental Protection Agency to curb greenhouse gases. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Lawyers for West Virginia, leading a coalition of mostly Republican-led states and coal companies, has asked the high court to review an appeals court ruling that would give the EPA greater authority to regulate greenhouse gases. That ruling is viewed as harmful by the coal industry. The Biden administration's already drafting a new rule to regulate carbon emissions, but the high court review could hinder that effort. The Supreme Court also announced it will consider whether Republican-led states can take over the defense of a Trump-era rule that denied green cards to immigrants who use public benefits like food stamps. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Security forces shot down three people during nationwide protests in Sudan on Saturday, a doctors' committee said, as hundreds of thousands of people demanded the restoration of a civilian-led government after a military takeover. Julianne Kitchener of Reuters reports.
Military forces shot dead at least three people and at least 38 were injured during nationwide protest in Sudan on Saturday, according to a doctors' committee, as hundreds of thousands of people demonstrated against a recent military coup. One witness said they heard gunshots and saw people being carried away bleeding in the city of Omdurman. Sudanese police denied shooting protesters. The military was not immediately available to comment. In the capital of Khartoum, security forces used tear gas and gunfire to try to disperse a huge crowd. Protesters on Saturday carried Sudanese flags and chanted slogans like, "Military rule can't be praised," as they marched in neighborhoods across Khartoum and beyond. Thousands of people have already demonstrated this week against the ousting of Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok's cabinet on Monday by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. And at least 13 protesters have been killed in clashes with security forces. Burhan has said he removed the cabinet to avert civil war after civilian politicians stoked hostility to the armed forces. He says he is still committed to a democratic transition, including elections in July 2023. The takeover has led Western states to freeze hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Sudan, where an economic crisis has seen shortages of food and medicine, and where nearly a third of the population is in need of urgent humanitarian support.
That's Gillian Kitchener of Reuters. The United Nations has condemned the killing of protesters by the Sudanese military and warned them to, quote, heed the voices of the people, unquote. U.S. Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for negotiations to return the country to a civilian-led government and respect of the rights of the people to protest peacefully. For an update on the situation, I spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
Well, the UN is very concerned from every direction. On Thursday, we saw finally that the UN Security Council's 15 members aligned themselves behind the African Union, who suspended Sudan last week, and they aligned themselves with the Arab League, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, and other organizations, and they expressed their serious concern. They did not outright condemn, but they expressed their serious concern of the, quote, military takeover. They didn't use the word coup, but neither did the African Union. So I think their language was mirroring that of the African Union. They condemned the military takeover, the state of emergency, the arrest of Prime Minister Hamdok. They called for his release, the use of restraint, the restoration of the civilian transition government. And they said they were with the people. So that was actually quite a strong statement from the Security Council. On Friday, Volker Perthes, who's the UN representative in Sudan, said that he was coordinating the mediation efforts. He's trying to push the parties towards inclusive talks. He spoke last week with Prime Minister Hamdok and also separately with General Burhan. So there's active mediation on the ground in Sudan. And on Saturday, in the midst of all the chaotic protests, We heard from the Secretary General, who's traveling this week. He was at the G20, and now he's at the climate conference in Scotland. And he called the Sudanese people courageous. He supported a peaceful protest, that the military must allow the people to peacefully protest. And he said the military should take heed of what the people are saying.
Protests are rocking Sudan, and more deaths are expected. Aside from talks and the international pressure coming up, any indications at all that the Sudanese military leadership will budge or give in to any of these demands?
We have to wait and see what happens. Militaries are difficult. We've seen that over the past year in Myanmar. The military leadership there hasn't listened to the international community. They've kind of laughed off sanctions, and they've just continued to isolate their country further internationally. I think the Sudanese military might be more intelligent because they've just gotten off the U.S. list of states of foreign terrorist sponsors, which is very important for them in order to have investment in the country. And Sudan's in a very dire economic situation. So there's different leverage in the case of Sudan's military coup, I think, perhaps, than in the case of Myanmar's. So we're just going to have to watch and see what happens, see what tools the international community has in its toolbox to try and, if not reverse the situation, at least bring it slowly back to some sort of civilian led situation.
Now that Prime Minister Hamdok is out of military detention and he's in his own home, do you know whether internally there's any discussions or talks with him from either the United Nations or any of the international organizations or pressure groups who are involved in this?
All I can tell you is that there have been repeated calls from the highest levels at the United Nations for his complete release. And last week, Mr. Perthes, the special representative for the UN to Sudan, spoke with him. But more than that, and he found him in good health. I think he met with him. And more than that, I'm not privy to.
Does the United Nations have an end game? Where do we go from here? And what are other steps or other plans the United Nations can take to bring the military into compliance?
Well, I don't think it's the United Nations' job to do that. It's the international community's. And we're going to see it from capital more than from New York. And the UN Security Council, as long as they keep giving their support to the African Union, this can be a regionally led effort to try and reverse the situation. The Security Council often says that the African countries should find solutions to African problems. They always say they support that because that's something the African Union talks about. So we'll have to see. There's mediation in the region, and we'll just have to see what happens.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from New York. Fighting has intensified in the Tigray region as Tigrayan forces claim to have seized the strategic town of Dessi in Ethiopia's Amhara region on Saturday, where thousands of ethnic Amharas have sought refuge. Rachel Judah of Reuters has more.
Rebellious Tigrayan forces say they have seized the strategic town of Dessi in Ethiopia's Amhara region, where thousands of ethnic Amharas have sought refuge from escalating violence. The Tigray People's Liberation Front's spokesperson, Getachew Reda, told Reuters their fighters pushed government forces from Dessi on Saturday and were heading towards Kombolcha in north-central Ethiopia. Seizing Dessi, some 240 miles from the capital Addis Ababa, would be a strategic gain for Tigrayan fighters against central government forces who were trying to dislodge them from the region. The TPLF spokesperson also said forces had captured many Ethiopian soldiers. Reuters has been unable to independently verify the TPLF's account of developments, and phone lines in Dessi appear to be down as of Saturday afternoon. Reports from residents say the Ethiopian army had retreated and that power had been off since Friday. Dessi is the furthest south in Amhara that the TPLF have reached since pushing into the region in July. In mid-October, the Tigrayan forces said the military had launched a ground offensive to push them out of Amhara. War broke out nearly a year ago between federal troops and the TPLF. Since then, thousands have been killed and more than 2 million people forced to flee. The government spokesperson, the mayor of Dessi, and a spokesperson for the town did not respond to requests for comment.
That's Rachel Judah of Reuters. The World Health Organization has kicked off a campaign to cut millions of road traffic deaths and injuries by at least half by 2030. This follows the August 2020 adoption by the United Nations General Assembly of a decade of action for road safety. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 50 million people have died in road crashes since the automobile was invented by German entrepreneur Carl Benz in 1886. Now the World Health Organization reports road accidents kill more than 3,500 people every day, adding up to nearly 1.3 million deaths and some 50 million injuries every year. The WHO cites road traffic injuries as the leading cause of death globally for children and young people aged 5 to 29 years. The director of the WHO's Department for Social Determinants, Etienne Krug, says most of these deaths and injuries are preventable. He says a centerpiece of the UN's global plan for reducing traffic accidents and saving lives is to get people out of their cars and have them shift to safer, healthier modes of transportation.
Move away from a car-based transportation system to more walking, cycling, and public transport. And to do that, we have to make it safe. The plan also advocates for involving more young people. As I said, it's the leading cause of death for young people, and giving them a bigger role in shaping this new way of transportation, and a greater role for private sector.
Krug says the private sector is important because of its responsibility for the safety of the vehicles it manufactures. He says a big source of danger is the large number of secondhand cars dumped by rich countries into developing countries.
Secondhand cars who are not up to the safety standards, who either are sold in the countries or are imported from other countries who don't want them anymore. And so regulating the export of used cars and the import on the other side is a very important part of improving safety on our road.
A report last year by the UN Environment Program found an estimated 14 million poor quality, highly polluting older vehicles were exported from Europe, Japan, and the United States between 2015 and 2018. Four out of five cars, it said, were sold to poorer countries, with more than half going to Africa. If things remain as they are, the World Health Organization warns an estimated 13 million deaths and 500 million injuries will occur during the next decade. Most of these preventable deaths and injuries, it says, will be in low and middle income countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, a senior State Department official says U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi on Sunday that the United States opposes actions taken by Beijing that have increased tensions across the Taiwan Strait. The official said during an hour-long meeting with Wang on the sidelines of the summit of a group of 20 leaders, Blinken made, quote, crystal clear, unquote, that Washington opposes any unilateral changes by Beijing to the status quo. The official said the United States wants to manage the intense competition between the world's two largest economies responsibly, adding that both sides acknowledge that open lines of communication are paramount. China's President Xi Jinping will participate in Rome Summit on October 30 to 31st via video link. Xi has not left China since early 2020, when the gravity of the COVID-19 pandemic became clear. A handful of other key players from wealthy G20 nations, including Russia President Vladimir Putin and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, will not attend in person. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo. Iran says it will return to talks with six major world powers on reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal by the end of November. The White House says the U.S. remains committed to a diplomatic path forward. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Iran has been hit hard by the coronavirus. At a time when the economy is already hurting from international sanctions over its nuclear program. In recent weeks, Iran's leaders have come under increasing pressure from Russia and the European Union to return to the multi-party talks in Vienna on reviving the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA. Iran now says it will return to the talks by the end of November. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki had this reaction.
Our commitment remains pursuing a diplomatic path forward. I would leave it to the negotiators to determine when the next round of discussions will be. Our framing continues to be compliance for compliance, and we'll leave it up to the Europeans and our negotiators to determine when the next step would be.
Do not expect quick results from any such talks, Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council tells VOA.
I think that there will be a lot of grandstanding, a lot of lecturing of the United States. I hope it will be direct. I mean, we still don't know if they're willing to sit in a room with the Americans or whether it's going to be, you know, a telephone game again like it was before. But there'll be a lot of complaints and posturing. But I hope in the end, yes, that even this government in Iran, which is a hardline government, will come down to and agree to serious negotiations.
Iran's new foreign minister said this week that U.S. President Joe Biden should show a gesture of goodwill first if Washington wants nuclear talks to resume. Alex Fatanka of the Middle East Institute tells VOA that Tehran wants verifiable sanctions relief.
They don't want sanctions relief on paper. They want sanctions relief in action. They actually want to see the billions of dollars that they have frozen sitting in foreign banks returned to Iran. So there's some concrete things can be done in the short term. You can, you know, allow for transfer of Iranian cash from banks around the world back to Iran, and they allow for Iranian oil to be exported.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled the U.S. out of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in May of 2018. Most Republican lawmakers still believe the Iran nuclear deal was a mistake and that the U.S. should not trust Tehran. This is another key concern for Iran, as Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute explains.
One of the key problems on the Iranian side is that they're very concerned that the United States' commitment to the JCPOA is depending upon which party is ruling the country. And as a result, it is quite destabilizing for them if the United States comes back into the deal, sanctions are lifted, the economy adjusts to sanctions being lifted, but then it's reimposed 3 years later when the next Republican president comes in.
Most experts agree that Tehran desperately needs the Iran nuclear deal to be fully reactivated so it can trade with the world again and investors can eventually regain the confidence to return and help restore its economy. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A 24-year-old Japanese man dressed in Batman's Joker costume attacked passengers on a Tokyo train on Sunday evening, injuring 17 people as partygoers headed into the city center for Halloween gatherings, media reported. Francesca Linag of Reuters reports.
A man dressed as Batman's Joker attacked passengers on a Tokyo train line on Sunday evening, injuring 17 people. As many partygoers headed into the city center for Halloween gatherings, Japanese media reported. One video uploaded to social media shows hordes of people running away from a train carriage. Another video shows passengers clambering out of windows onto the station platform. Speaking to local media, witnesses said the attacker was armed with a knife and spread fluid around the train to start a fire. Police arrested the suspected attacker on the spot, media reported, on the day the nation voted in a parliamentary election.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Achebe in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.
Glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa News. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.